So this is our VA reading group, continuing our reading of Cybernetics and the Origin of Information. We are in chapter three, picking up on page 70. We had a little bit of confusion before we started recording about where exactly we are, but that's where we're gonna pick up from. This chapter has to do with his concept that he wants to introduce that he called axiological space, but here space, of course, in quotation marks, because it's not spatial in the sense of physical space. And he insists precisely on the fact that this axiological space is not spatial. So this is one of his main criticisms of the Gestalt psychologists is the fact that they insist on, or they don't sort of get away from the relationship between their like sort of dynamic field of tensions that they use to explain behavior and physical space. So if they were to explain, for example, the action of picking up a coffee cup, they would explain it in terms of this sort of like trajectory or this gradient of tension, like from your position of your arm, say on the armrest of your chair, towards the coffee cup. So you'd have this sort of like moving your arm towards the coffee cup would be the path through which you would reduce the tension in this sort of dynamic field of behavior. And what the sort of general objection that Huye has to this approach to explaining behavior is that it sort of presupposes or it requires a kind of orientation, a non-spatial orientation in relation to these values or in relation to this axiological space that would be prior to the orientation towards minimizing tension in this sort of dynamic field of behavior. So the action of reaching for the coffee cup only reduces tension if you have some sort of general orientation towards like the value of drinking coffee, for example, or like if you decide that drinking coffee is good, then you'll have this sort of minimization of tension that happens by reaching for the coffee cup. But if you are like abstaining from coffee, if you're like trying to resist the temptation to drink coffee, then reaching for the coffee cup would probably increase the tension in your sort of dynamic behavioral field. So you can't just sort of read off from the layout of the environment, you know, what the sort of minimization of tension gradient is. You have to sort of start from this orientation towards values or towards this axiological space. Like where is this person situated or this organism situated in relation to axiological space? And then only based on that orientation in axiological space can you then discover the layout of the dynamic behavioral field and this sort of gradient of tension. So this is like his general objection that we have to sort of these sorts of explanations in terms of something actual, something that is present now, they sort of presuppose something non-actual that regulates or orients that relationship to what is actual. And so like a further example of this that he describes is, so it's a passage from one of Stendhal's books that I believe one of the, Leven had talked about as, so he Leven brings this up as a sort of possible objection to this like dynamic behavioral field approach to explaining behavior. So it's, you have this man, Julien, who, sort of says to himself that he's going to ask Mademoiselle de Rênal to marry him by 10 o'clock. And if he hasn't done so by 10 o'clock, he's going to blow his brains out. And so a sort of, first order explanation or description of this situation, it's not sort of obvious that this can be mapped onto this sort of dynamic behavioral field, explanation of behavior that, it's less obvious than the sort of picking up a coffee cup example. But Leven tries to say, this isn't really like a counterexample because the sort of image, the image of, asking Mademoiselle de Rênal to marry me is in the head, it is an actual sort of present event in the mind of Julien. So it's not this sort of nebulous future circumstance that is like acting on Julien. It's the present sort of representation in his mind that is acting on him. What Rie points out is this is kind of like we could even sort of compare this to Kant's arguments about the paralogisms of reason. Here is that you're sort of taking two incompatible aspects of the situation and sort of fusing them into one, because the sort of psychological reality, this image that is actually occurring in the mind of Julien, in itself has no sort of dynamic quality or dynamic force on Julien. Like, if we suppose by some sort of bizarre like telepathy that some random other person in like, I don't know, Argentina or something, that far away from this scene, is like has this exact same image in their mind, it would be sort of puzzling and bizarre for them, but they wouldn't feel this sort of tension and all the sort of anxiety that is provoked by this image in the mind of Julien. It would just be this image of some woman and some man and this little scene or whatever, but the image as such has no force or effect on the behavior of the person. It's only insofar as that image has some sort of dynamic connection to this axiological space, that it has the capacity to bring about this anxiety and tension and make Julien make this sort of dramatic decision and so on. So on the one hand, you have this image, which is something present, as Levin says, it is something that is actually in the mind of Julien at this moment, but as an image, it has no sort of dynamic force, it has no effect on his behavior. But then on the other hand, you have this ideal of marrying Mademoiselle de Rênal, which is not present. It's something that is supposed to happen in the future. It's this goal that he's orienting himself towards. But precisely insofar as it is this goal, it is not acting in the present. So Levin is kind of conflating these two things. He's sort of fusing the present existence of that comes from the psychological image on the one hand, with the sort of dynamic quality of the ghoul that infuses it with this sort of dynamic attractive value on the other hand. And so he's sort of like combining the two halves of the sort of situation in a way that sort of glosses over the fact that these are actually different aspects of the situation. And so we have to preserve this distinction between my sort of image or representation or like the psychological process occurring in my mind that is sort of the representation of the goal on the one hand, and then the goal itself on the other hand, or the ideal towards which I'm directed on the other hand. And so these are two distinct kinds of things, and we can't sort of conflate them with each other. So yeah, so in general, when we're explaining behavior of a person or even other animals, we have to keep this distinction in mind. We have to distinguish between what is actually in the mind as a psychological reality of some kind, in the present, and then what is the sort of directedness of that representation? What is it representing? These are two different things. And this is like, you can make a parallel with it's sort of like one of the key concepts that Husserl introduces in phenomenology, is that the what you intend, like what your representation represents, is not itself something psychological. That like if you are thinking about the law of non-contradiction, there might be some sort of psychological manifestation of that law. Like it might be empirically the case that you can't believe A and not A at the same time, but that is not itself what the law of non-contradiction is. You are sort of the object that you're intending is not itself psychological. This is like the whole argument of volume one of the Logical Investigations. So I think Rie is making a similar point here, is that like your directedness, your behavior that is oriented towards a goal, even if the goal itself is sort of represented by this psychological reality, there's still this distinction. Like the goal is not itself a psychological reality just by even though that psychological reality is part of the process by means of which your behavior is directed towards that goal. Okay, so let's pick up from page 70 at regardless of the angle. Someone else would like to read from there?
I can read. Regardless of the angle chosen for its study, the problem of psychobiological action is unsolvable unless the hypergeometric dimension is taken into account. Let us take, for example, the idea of possibility. Quote, the fundamental constructs which we use in representing the situation must consist of concepts from which one can derive unambiguously certain events as quote-unquote possible, others as quote-unquote not possible. I don't know where this quote ends. I think that open quote was maybe a mistake. But the man who seeks an ideal does not always know whether or not it can be realized. If it is only a matter of taking a full glass on the table without knocking it over, in the visible absence of obstacles, it is as if the possibility is inscribed in the field of vision. When it comes down to it, this possibility is already transphysical, as it only defines itself by quote-unquote survey and quote-unquote knowledge, but ultimately it is easily calculable. The success of the feedback is unambiguously predictable. But an inventor, by definition, can never clearly know in his quote-unquote life space whether what he is looking for is possible. The moment he perceives this possibility, his problem, by definition, is virtually solved. Possibility is not a simple concept. It has stages that correspond to different quote-unquote distances along the hypergeometric dimension. If the possibilities were included in the field, and if the dynamic situation was fully representable, the activity would stop as soon as the equilibrium position is reached. The quote-unquote actualists are indeed compelled to recognize that this consequence is contradicted by the facts, especially in the case of human beings. David Crutch and Richard S. Crutchfield, while affirming, with Levin, whom they claim to follow, that, quote, there is a constant tendency for the psychological of the change in the direction of a reduction of tension, quote, are indeed compelled to add that this, quote, does not imply that the achievement of a state of equilibrium is the goal of the individual's action, unquote. But it is difficult to see how this incontestable fact can be reconciled with their hypothesis. Crutch and Crutchfield attempt two explanations, each very different. The first is mechanist. While in simple physicochemical systems, the final state of equilibrium is the same as the initial state, for example, when the blood's pH is unbalanced due to intense activity, the respiration speeds up in order to return the pH to its initial level. In the psychological field, the final equilibrium is almost always different to the initial equilibrium. Its history is not that of a single fluctuating system, always returning to the same position. Quote, it is rather a history of changing equilibria, in which the psychological field restructures continuously, unquote. This explanation is clearly insufficient. It does not answer the question, which is to know why the achievement of an equilibrium state is not the goal of an individual's activity. Assuming that the activity is controlled by a set of multiple interrelated feedback loops, like Ashby's homeostat, it would still be seeking successive equilibria, and it would not be its own fault, but that of the environment, milieu, if a final equilibrium were never found. The second explanation is very different. Crutch and Crutchfield appeal to the person's progressive physical and psychological differentiation in his efforts to integrate increasingly complex states through a hierarchical and mobile system of values. The individual's, quote, level of aspiration, unquote, is raised as he achieves his first goals. He, quote, continuously sets for himself new levels of accomplishment, his levels of aspiration, that are above those of his present achievements, unquote. This is absolutely true, but it amounts to the complete rejection of the initial actualist hypothesis. Crutch and Crutchfield can't help but notice, quote, this phenomenon seems to contradict a simple theory that behavior tends toward equilibrium. Here it seems that an equilibrium is voluntarily abandoned and a tension deliberately set up. The person seems to be pulling himself up by his own bootstraps, unquote. Clearly, the sole conclusion possible here is to reject Levin's fallacious postulates and the bias of a spatiotemporal dynamism. So it seems like the first point he's making is that if behavior were explicable in terms of this kind of present field of behavior, or whatever Levin's alternative but similar explanation is, it would be difficult to explain phenomena like invention, where the inventor necessarily doesn't know from the outset what the end product of the process of invention is going to be. So it's not something that the behavioral field theory can relatively easily explain, something like reaching for a cup of water, which is visible on a table. But the end state of the process of invention is not present in the same sense that the cup of water is present. And then the other problem that it has is that people tend to not rest satisfied with achieving a given equilibrium state and even create new tensions, which perhaps don't have a determinate end equilibrium state in mind or present to the person when these new tensions arise, in order to, you know, eventually pursue something that will become a new equilibrium state, which then itself abandoned and pursued for something else.
Yeah. So yeah, this, yeah, cup of water or cup of coffee, whatever, you know, this example, you have the thing right in front of you, and you have this sort of path through this dynamic space that sort of leads from, you know, your arm resting by your side to your arm picking up the coffee cup. But then, you know, if the problem is, you know, inventing a new type of motor, for example, the new motor, if you had the motor in front of you, even in your mind, as, you know, a representation in your mind, the problem would be solved, essentially. The whole point of inventing something is that it doesn't exist yet. It's not actually present. So it's, yeah, or a mathematical proof, exactly the same problem, where, like, you're trying to prove something. If you knew what it is you were trying, or if you knew how to prove it, then you would have solved the problem already. So, like, your sort of situation that you're faced with is where something that you don't have present is actually sort of, drawing you, or that you are sort of oriented towards. And this actually, this reminds me of something that Poincaré talks about, where he talks about like the sort of unconscious work that is sort of that goes into a proof, where he says, like, he gives a story of, like, he was working on something, all afternoon or something like that. And then he couldn't solve, you know, he's trying different solutions, couldn't find, you know, how to prove something. He goes to bed, he goes out for dinner or something. And then he's on his way home, and he, like, steps onto the streetcar. And then as soon as he steps onto the streetcar, he like suddenly realizes, oh, this is how I have to solve it. And he goes home and he just, like, you know, writes down the whole thing. Like, he just, you know, has this sort of immediate insight into how to solve the problem. So, like, somehow the work that he had been doing, you know, consciously before, was sitting at his desk writing things on paper, had sort of, like, continued in the background as he was, you know, out for dinner talking with friends or whatever. And then, you know, this sort of the solution, you know, sort of appeared of itself. He wasn't sort of aware of working on it, but it just sort of appeared. But, you know, this whole situation, demonstrates that precisely the goal, this solution to the problem, how do I prove this theorem, was not there at the outset. That he had sort of, like, a vague understanding of, this is what I want to prove. But, you know, as soon as he grasped the actual, the solution, it was sort of immediately present. And then all he had to do was write it down and, you know, check that it was correct and so on. And he talks about how, like, every occasion where this kind of thing happens, where he, like, sort of has this immediate insight into the solution, when he has gone back and checked that it's correct, he's never been mistaken. That he's never, like, you know, sort of had this experience, oh, this is the correct solution, and then gone down and sat down to the desk and checked it, and then found, oh, it's actually not correct. So he has this sort of, like, grasp of the correct solution that hasn't led him astray. What this kind of example shows is that when you do have that grasp of the solution, so when the solution is actually present to your mind in this sort of psychological reality, at that point the problem is essentially solved. You just have to sort of set it down on paper and, you know, verify that everything works as you want it to, or at least if you're, like, a mathematical genius like Poincaré. When, you know, the previous state where he's sitting at his desk, you know, trying different possibilities, trying to figure things out, the solution is not present, like just almost by definition, right? Because he's still working on it. So you can't sort of explain his directedness towards the solution in terms of something that will be present, because it's only once it is present, the problem is like essentially solved. So it's again this kind of disjunction between the two sides of, you know, the psychological reality of the goal, you know, proving this theorem, and then the goal itself, you know, the theorem actually being proved, where, you know, they don't coincide temporally, because you know, when you're sitting at your desk trying to solve prove this theorem, you don't have the solution in front of you as a psychological reality. And this isn't, you know, specific to a mathematical proof. Like in this case, it's maybe more straightforward to see, because there's like, you know, you can sort of verify that your proof is correct or incorrect. But you can think of something similar, like writing a poem, for example. You're stuck on, you know, what do I write next? What's the next line? And you try different things and you go, oh, that's not really what I wanted. That's not good. You know, it doesn't sort of fit with the rest of it or whatever. And then maybe you get frustrated and you leave, and then you're out for a walk, and then suddenly you go, oh, that's the right line. Here, I have the next line, right? And so it just sort of, you know, comes to you, right? And it's not something that you don't have any awareness of, like, working on it, but then it just sort of suddenly appears. And it's this very strange experience. It again shows this kind of disjunction between the psychological representation of the goal of, like, you know, finding the line that fits correctly at this point in the poem. And then the, you know, realization of that is not itself a psychological reality. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, Bass in the chat here has mentioned the ancient Greek concept of the muses, and Homer talks about, like, I think it's in the Ion, if I remember correctly, the interpreters of the Odyssey that sort of or of the Homeric poems that that sort of understood themselves as being divinely inspired, because, you know, there are these passages that, you know, maybe are not obvious to interpret, and they just sort of think about them, and then suddenly they get this idea, oh, this passage means X, and, you know, you can't really explain where that idea comes from, or like how do you suddenly understand a passage that before seemed obscure. And so yeah, just, you know, describing this as, you know, a divine inspiration is kind of like a label for, like, this kind of experience of a solution to a problem, like, suddenly appearing and, you know, not having an explanation for, you know, where it comes from. It actually reminds me, I think, I can't remember where exactly it comes up, but Simondon talks about how in one of Homer, in either the Iliad or the Odyssey, there's a depiction of a dream as something that arrives from outside, like, I think it's the Iliad, it's the Odyssey, I believe, and Odysseus is lying in bed, and the dream sort of walks up to the bed and, like, appears to him. The dream is not something that's, like, internal to Odysseus, like, in his mind. It's something external that comes to him. And, of course, you know, there was the sort of practice of dream interpretation as a kind of divination that, like, you know, your dream was a message sent to you, you know, from a god, or, you know, from some sort of external power, and you had to sort of interpret what does this mean for, you know, my life and my, you know, the decision that I'm struggling with or whatever, this is sort of like the same kind of experience. You know, of course, our dreams often are quite bizarre and have, like, you know, what the connection is with our sort of everyday life and our you know, the practices that we're aware of, that, you know, you think about a problem, you know, do I want to declare war or not? If you're, you know, the king of some city, right? You're trying to decide, am I going to go to war, right? Or am I going to make peace, et cetera? And then you have this dream that might not have any obvious, you know, connection to that problem. You know, you dream about, I don't know, seeing a dolphin that talks to you or something. I don't know, some absurd thing like that. And then you have to sort of interpret this dream as in terms of what it means for your decision. So sometimes you have this dream where this absurd situation, you just have this sort of like immediate sort of insight into, oh, this actually means X, or like this person that looks completely different is actually, you know, my father or my neighbor or whoever it is. You sort of know things, or you have this immediate impression of something, even though it doesn't actually sort of make sense in connection with what is like present in the dream. And so this experience of having this like message sort of appear to you without any like understanding of where it comes from is sort of like what I think is being expressed when they describe the dream as being, you know, sent by the gods or something like that. And so, yeah, so these like decisions that you sort of use a dream to make are, you know, described as being divinely inspired. And Rie has a book on Homer that I have not read, but I wonder if any of this stuff comes up in there. Okay, so we can go on to the next bit from the heading Ideal Barriers, if someone else could read from there.
Yeah, you can read. Ideal barrier, the barriers that prevent the student from solving a mathematics problem, although he is, quote-unquote, moving toward the solution, cannot be put on the same level as physical barriers, or even social barriers, although these always have an ideal component, which prevent him from going out to play. There are barriers between the space-time world and the hyperdimensional world. Clearly, humanity has to overcome some barriers in order to conquer the still uncharted world of future techniques. The discoveries of electronics, plastics, nuclear energy, or plutonium were not faced with the same kinds of challenges as those that prevented Europeans, before Columbus, from reaching America. We also have, in the present state of techniques, more or less difficult access to trans-space, to free regions, and more or less strong barriers with some communications and pathways. Biological evolution has already taken place through successive conquests and the overcoming of barriers in the trans-spatial domain. Over the last few centuries, it has been achieved much more through technical conquests in the fashion of Western science than through geographical conquests in the fashion of Columbus' discovery of America. It is almost always the annexation of a technical domain which then allows geographical annexation in both the biological and the cultural evolution of mankind. Ideal locomotion precedes and enables physical locomotion. Marine organisms only invaded land after learning to breathe oxygen from the air. Man only moved through the atmosphere after having found the combustion engine, and the jet engine opened up the possibility of interplanetary travel. Cybernetics itself represents a field of possibilities that had to be conquered by this ideal locomotion in the transspatial, that is, invention. The quote-unquote cephalization of human industry continues the cephalization of vertebrates and simians, and it ensures the control of mankind over the geographical environment. The very success of cybernetics conceals the condition of this success for the same general reasons that industrial technology, the triumph of the inventive spirit, and the conquering of the transspatial appear to superficial minds as the triumph of materialism. It is this same general illusion that makes mankind believe that intelligence and reason are autonomous, completely cut off from animal instinct, which is nevertheless the primary manifestation of the connection between space-time and the trans-spatial. Oh, that ends the chapter. I guess we can stop here, and then I can keep reading.
Let's stop here, actually, for the moment. We can pick up the rest afterwards. A translation point. In the English, it says jet engines and talks about possibility interplanetary voyages, and that actually is not correct for a jet engine, of course, that jet engines rely on air and so are obviously not usable in interplanetary space. But the French term is moteur à réaction, which is a broader category which would include both jet engines and rockets, which are, of course, usable in space. So the English translation uses a narrower term, which makes the claim false, but Rie actually uses the broader term, which would include rockets that would make the claim true. So his translators have done him an injustice here, but obviously that doesn't have you know, much significance for the overall argument. But yeah, so what he's talking about here is you can make a distinction between this sort of physical barrier, or even, and he even describes social barriers. So the kids who are inside the classroom, they have, like, say, a wall and a door, et cetera, between them and the playground outside. And so this wall is a barrier in the physical sense. And they also, I mean, of course, they can, the kid in the classroom could always stand up and open the door and walk outside. But there's the social barrier that, you know, if they do that, the teacher will yell at them or whatever. They are sort of not supposed to do that until recess. But in this situation, the playground that, you know, the child is separated from by the physical and social barriers is still always, you know, something that exists, you know, just outside the room. And it's precisely actually this sort of the fact that the playground is right outside that can make it so, like, alluring and sort of intolerable to be sitting inside the classroom when the playground is so inviting, you know, right outside the window. But then this is not the same kind of situation as, you know, the example from Poincaré that I mentioned before, where you're sitting at the desk trying to solve a problem, trying to, you know, figure out how to prove this theorem. The solution to this problem, the proof of the theorem, is not there, even, you know, outside your office, or, you know, separated by a social barrier. It's something that doesn't really exist yet, or has this sort of nebulous potential existence in the transpatial realm outside of your sort of reality. So it's a quite different type of barrier. And even, you know, in the case of Poincaré, he's like inventing something that doesn't exist yet. But you can also think of, like, you know, the child who is, you know, trying to, I don't know, figure out how to do long division, that, you know, they've sort of half grasped the lesson, and they're trying to sit down and do the homework. And they, you know, this is something that, of course, has existed for hundreds of years. They're not inventing something new, but they still have to, there's a sort of, like, you know, we talk about, like, an intellectual block sometimes, that, like, you just, like, are sitting there trying to understand some concept or technique or whatever that you're supposed to learn in school, and you just, like, for whatever reason, it just is not making sense to you. And sometimes you might just sit there for hours, or you know, this might last a whole semester even, that you're, like, trying to figure out, you know, what exactly is going on in this domain that I'm supposed to learn about. And then sometimes you just have this sort of, like, insight, and you go, oh, okay, now I get it. Now I understand, you know, what I'm supposed to do, or how this is supposed to work, etc. And sometimes that doesn't happen, of course. This is a very different type of barrier than, you know, not being allowed to go into the playground. And what Rie is arguing, or what he suggests in this passage, is that a lot of the, you know, progression, like overcoming a physical or even a social barrier, in many cases requires, as a prerequisite, overcoming this ideal barrier. You have to sort of invent something, get over this intellectual block before you can sort of overcome a physical barrier or a social barrier. So, you know, crossing an ocean, for example, you have to figure out how to build a ship that, you know, has certain characteristics that, you know, you can, it can withstand storms, and you have to, you know, invent navigation techniques and so on, like, before you can, you know, cross this physical barrier that the ocean constitutes. You have to, you know, overcome all the sort of intellectual obstacles to successful navigation across an ocean. So he even applies this to biological evolution. So we talked about, like, marine organisms that learn how to breathe air before they are able to move from the marine environment to a land environment. And so, like, there are certain fish, for example, like fish, mostly, as we know, they rely on gills, where they are getting oxygen from the water surrounding them. But there are certain environments, like in the Amazon, for example, that are low oxygen environments. The water has very low levels of oxygen in it, and these fish actually do breathe. They have to come up into the air to get oxygen. And so you can sort of imagine, and this is, like, probably more or less what happened in evolutionary history, that some sort of fish or similar marine organism that, you know, had this capacity to get oxygen from the air would, say, like, live in a tidal pool, and then eventually was able to adapt to the tidal pool drying up completely and maybe move to another tidal pool, you know, by sort of crawling on the land, and then, you know, gradually sort of becomes less and less dependent on the tidal pool and is able to sort of travel on a completely land-based existence and not rely on water in any way. And so this is like this progression from a marine environment to a land environment is only possible by like through this invention or this discovery of the capacity to get the oxygen that you need for your, you know, metabolic processes from the air instead of from the water. So yeah, overcoming this sort of physical barrier between the marine environment and the land environment is a result of overcoming this, well, you can't really call it an intellectual barrier, but say an evolutionary barrier between water-based oxygen extraction and air-based oxygen extraction.
Yeah, the brief comment at the end of the chapter where he talks about animal instinct as the primary manifestation of the connection between space-time and the transspatial. I suppose he's talking about the kind of evolutionary quote-unquote invention exemplified by the evolution of the ability to breathe air. But I wish he had said a bit more about the continuity between instinct and intelligence. I think in the next chapter, if I remember correctly, he mentions instinct as sort of moving up away from the horizontal line of the, I guess, purely causal and into the ideal, in a manner similar to symbolic communication. But yeah, I find myself wishing he had developed that a bit more.
Yeah, you're right that he's very sort of elusive here. He just sort of, you know, mentions this idea and then doesn't really develop it. I think we can maybe connect this to what we saw in the Merleau-Ponty book, The Structure of Behavior, where he talks about these sort of three levels of behavior, where you have like certain organisms have this sort of very direct stimulus response type of behavior. Like he talks about the toad that sees the worm and then extends its tongue. And then even though there's a pane of glass between the toad and the worm, and it can't actually reach the worm just by flicking its tongue out, it just keeps doing it over and over again, just because it, like, the sight of the worm just sort of triggers this response in a very sort of one-to-one way. But then, like, in the slightly more sophisticated type of behavior, the animal will sort of aim towards a goal and be able to reach that goal through a variety of means, and you know, take a detour, for example, where, like, if the sort of usual way of getting this goal doesn't actually work, if you, like, find yourself, you know, running into a mysterious obstacle that you can't see over and over again, then you suddenly, you know, have an insight, or the you know, slightly smarter toad decides to, instead of, you know, flicking out his tongue over and over again, decides to, you know, climb this mysterious invisible obstacle and get to the other side where it can reach the worm. Or like the example that, you know, Merleau-Ponty talked about is that, yeah, the chickens that learn to peck the, to press the button or whatever it is that has the lighter gray, you know, whether or not the, you know, whatever the actual shade of gray is, they learn how to pick the lighter of the two that are presented to them. And this, you know, lighter is not a sort of direct stimulus response correlation. It's instead, you know, a sort of grasp of a structure, obviously a very simple structure in this case, of just like, you know, is this shade lighter or darker than the other one? But at the same time, they're sort of responding to a structure of a situation and acting in an appropriate way. And, you know, in more sort of natural settings, you have, you know, like a predator animal will chase its prey. It doesn't have like a sort of pre-built response to the sight of the prey, because, you know, you could see, you know, say it's a bird of prey that's chasing, you know, an owl that's chasing a mouse across the field or whatever. The mouse could appear from, you know, a million different angles. The mouse could be slightly bigger or smaller, and you're slightly different color. The lighting could be different, et cetera. So like, you can't have this sort of like pre-built stimulus response pairing for the owl to catch the mouse. It has to, you know, flexibly adapt to the environment of, you know, where the mouse is located and, you know, exactly how big the mouse is and so on, how fast it's moving. And it's this sort of flexible orientation towards a goal, I think, is what Rui has in mind here when he talks about animal instinct. So the owl is sort of oriented towards this ideal object, this, you know, mouse catching object. And it sort of actualizes this ideal in a flexible way, rather than having this like sort of hardwired pairing of, you know, this visual stimulus releases this action. And I think this is what Rui is sort of pointing to as like a sort of exemplar of the realization of an ideal, of something transpatial. So even in the much more sort of sophisticated cases of, you know, the mathematician sitting at the desk trying to prove a theorem, it's the same sort of overall structure or overall type of process as the owl chasing the mouse. You have this sort of non-spatial or transpatial ideal that you're trying to, you know, bring into an actual spatial temporal existence. You know, in the case of the mathematician, it's, you know, some marks on a piece of paper or whatever. Or yeah, maybe Poincaré, yeah, suddenly realizes how to, you know, pounce on a mouse and eat it. Though that seems unlikely. Hopefully that is not what happened. Or maybe the mouse learned how to, or maybe the owl learned how to, you know, prove the three body theorem or whatever. Yeah, this is the same kind of process of taking something that is non-spatial or transpatial and, you know, giving it manifestation in physical spatial reality. I think this is what he's sort of pointing to when he talks about animal instinct, and especially it's not just a sort of linear process of, you know, something, you know, non-spatial that becomes spatial, but it's this sort of flexible adaptation of something non-spatial to what is spatial and what is given in the circumstances that the organism finds itself in. I think this is what he's pointing to when he talks about animal instinct. And so like the inventor, the inventor, of course, uses things like intelligence and reason. So, you know, if you're sitting down to figure out how do I, you know, make a human being fly, it's obviously quite important to know things about, you know, mechanics and aerodynamics and how engines work and so on. Like having all this knowledge is quite useful. It would be quite difficult to, you know, figure out how to make a person fly if you didn't know anything about any of those topics. But in itself, you know, memorizing a textbook on aerodynamics is not going to, you know, give you the capacity to invent an airplane. You have to, you know, take that knowledge and then have this sort of creative capacity, this, you know, insight and inventiveness and so on to, you know, apply that knowledge in a way that had not been done before. And so I think that's what Rui is pointing to here is this, you know, the fact that you have to, it's only because human beings have this capacity of giving reality to this transpatial ideal sort of in the first place. This is like the basic prerequisite for the possibility of taking knowledge and intelligence and so on and putting it to work to realize that ideal in these various special cases, like, you know, inventing an airplane, proving a mathematical theorem, et cetera.
Yeah, thanks. That's helpful to see the continuity in the progression along the different types of behavior that Merleau-Ponty talks about. And you can see it as kind of Rouillé talks about distinction between horizontal and vertical dimensions. So maybe a kind of progression into greater and greater degree of virtuality. Like I remember Merleau-Ponty talking about a dog that can learn a sign that means that it's supposed to jump up onto a chair, but that it won't understand the same sign to mean that it should jump up onto some other kind of furniture. And then he contrasts this with the ability of human musicians to improvise on instruments that are similar but not identical to the instruments that they've seen before. And so there's just a much greater degree of virtuality in the second case, but perhaps not a difference in kind between the two.
Yeah, so like you know, if you're if you play piano, for example, you generally are not going to be, and you're a touring musician, you generally are not, you know, bringing your piano with you everywhere. You're not using the exact same piano. You go to a concert hall and you use the piano that's there. And of course, there's, you know, a certain amount of standardization of pianos that, like, you know, you don't have, you're not going to show up at the concert hall and find that the low keys are on the right and the high keys are on the left, and like just have like an inverted keyboard. In general, the layout of the keyboard is going to be the same, or like you wouldn't have, you know, black and white keys reversed or whatever. But at the same time, the, you know, precise size and so on of the, and, you know, the beveling of each key and so on, all these things are going to be slightly different. And, you know, the exact tension in the key, like how hard you have to press it and so on, all these things are going to be slightly different in from one piano to the next. And of course, the musician is not sort of limited to, you know, virtuoso performance on their one home piano and then zero ability on a slightly different piano in the concert hall. You know, you might have better results on an instrument that you're familiar with, but at the same time, you are capable of, you know, playing and probably in a way that most of us would not be able to detect any difference, you know, on the piano in the concert hall. So yeah, you have this like capacity to adapt your behavior, your, you know, the micro actions of moving your fingers and so on. All of that is adapted to the circumstance. And yeah, so this is even, as Angus points out in the chat here, that this is even the case with the toad to some extent, because the toad is not like responding to you know, a very specific, you know, this precise worm in this precise orientation. It's like some vaguely line shaped color patch that is moving in a certain way that the toad responds to. And, you know, many different worms, or even, you know, probably a piece of string that, you know, you are sort of pulling in a certain way to make it move like this, like all of these different entities will fall under that sort of general image that the toad has of you know, a worm shaped object. So it's still, even though the toad's behavior is in many ways quite inflexible, at the same time, it's like not limited to one very precise, you know, single image that it has to respond to in this way. And this is maybe like when we think about, you know, robots and sort of computer control systems, this is like, I think we've talked about this, like maybe during the Merleau-Ponty reading, but like already at the time Ruyer was writing, there was research on, I think he might even mention it here, research on like, how do you get a computer to recognize a letter that could be, you know, different people's handwriting, different sizes, different orientations. You know, the camera could be pointing at a different angle towards the page, and so on. So how do you recognize that? How do you get a computer to recognize that this is a letter A, even though in one person's handwriting, in different ink on a different type of paper, different lighting, et cetera, all these things are different. How do you get it to recognize the invariant, you know, type of symbol that it is? And this, I mean, today this is like pretty well, you know, managed by computers. Of course, you can just take a scan of a page and do OCR on it and get, depending on the type of font and the program you use, you get varying quality of results. But, you know, with a pretty good results on like a sort of average situation of a text. But this is non-trivial. This is something that only in the last like 10, 15 years or so has been like really sort of usable. And the research on this was starting, you know, already in like the 1950s when he's writing this book. So it took like many decades of work, you know, by all these like high-powered, you know, MIT PhD students and so on, to get this to actually function in a way that is like more or less adequate. So it just sort of shows that even something that seems quite trivial, like being able to recognize a letter, this is something you can, you know, get a 5-year-old to do pretty well. This task is actually quite non-trivial if you have to, like, computers, of course, don't have this animal instinct of, like, you know, the sort of capacity to flexibly apply some sort of ideal to a situation. You have to, like, tell it in a very, very detailed and literal way exactly what you want it to do, as anyone who has experience in computer programming will know to their chagrin that they do exactly what you tell them to do, even if that is not what you actually wanted it to do. So yeah, getting a computer to recognize a letter is actually quite complicated, and is not is much more complicated than you might expect from the fact that you can just teach a 5-year-old by like showing here's a bunch of examples of the letter A, and then you know after like 5 or 10 examples they just sort of get it, right? Computers don't ever just get things in that way. And this actually, I mean, this is slightly diverging from the topic, but this of course in the last couple of weeks the whole DeepSeek episode has occurred, where there was this Chinese company that developed this AI model DeepSeek, apparently for I think around $5 or $6 million, compared to like ChatGPT is like a multi-billion-dollar enterprise to develop that model, and the performance it seems to be comparable. And so there's like, and of course it's causing all kinds of panic among these companies that have these multi-billion-dollar valuations based on the premise that you need all this money to develop a model that can do these things, which doesn't seem to be that the amount of confidence you can have in that presupposition has declined dramatically in the last couple of weeks. But part of what this shows is that like a lot of the AI models that exist today, if you want to train an AI to recognize pictures of dogs, for example, like at like similar levels of performance to humans, of course a human can recognize a picture of a dog, not just in one, one breed of dog from one angle in one type of lighting and so on, but a human who sort of is familiar with dogs, as most humans are, can recognize a dog from many angles, many different breeds, many different lighting settings and so on. But a computer, a computer vision system, you actually have to give it all the examples of, all these different types of lighting and everything. It can't sort of, or in general, it doesn't do well at extrapolating from what it has already seen to, types of images that it hasn't seen. So like if you only feed it pictures of one breed of dog, it will not do that well with another breed of dog that has like maybe a different, like if you only give it Great Danes, it will not be able to recognize Chihuahuas very well, for example. Or if you only give it dogs, from a front view, it will not do well at recognizing dogs from the side, and so on. All the different like variations on pictures of dogs. So you have to give it like to get a computer vision system to have like human level performance at recognizing dogs. You have to give it like millions of different pictures, because it has to have examples of like every possible breed and every possible lighting and angle and so on. Whereas, when you think of like a child learning the concept of a dog, it like you show a child like one picture of a dog or a couple pictures of a dog, it is capable of grasping, this is a dog. And sometimes they of course make mistakes, right? Like a common mistake is that children will over apply a concept that they learn. So like if you have a dog at home, the child will just call every like four-legged mammal a dog, like the squirrel outside is a dog, etc. But fairly quickly we'll learn that that's not the right extension of the concept. You think of, and Simon Do talks about like the child that sees a tiger for the first time, like how this like sort of immediate impact of this perception of the tiger, that like you don't have to show a child millions of pictures of tigers before it goes, okay, now I can use the word tiger in the appropriate circumstances. It's like you see the tiger once and then you sort of, grasp, the concept of a tiger. So obviously the learning that the child is doing is like vastly more efficient than the learning that a computer vision system is doing. And what this sort of DeepSeek episode seems to show is that, there's like, even in the realm of artificial intelligence, there's like a lot of room for more efficiency, where you don't need to churn through like every single piece of text on the internet to produce a model that is capable of like answering what time a movie is showing without inventing what year it is, like the famous Bing episode. I think Huye would, I mean, obviously he would be like, I think quite surprised by some of the capacities that LLMs have shown, like the capacity to translate a text quite well, things like that. But I think he would also, not be surprised by the fact that DeepSeek and this sort of DeepSeek incident has shown that a lot of these systems are extremely inefficient at, you know, they're learning, you know, they require far more data to produce the kinds of performances that we see than it requires for a human to produce comparable performances. Okay, so I'm going to suggest that we stop here. I think we ended up rereading the last little bit. I think we had read that last time because I think started in the wrong place. But yeah, I'm going to suggest we stop here at the chapter break. I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with rereading because, of course, we can get different things out of it each time we read it. So we can stop here and hopefully not pick up again on the same part that we read last time for a third repetition. We'll start from the beginning of chapter 4 next time.
That sounds good. Thanks, Nan. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Yeah, thanks. See you next time.